Okay, well, the tremendous revolutionary upheavals of 1978 threw up and started to pose the whole series of questions for the Bloc Party. And, you know, right throughout the year, you know, as the shifting tide of the revolution and so on, all sorts of questions were posed, and there was heated internal debate about how the Bloc should arrange. Now, some of the most famous controversies of the year obviously settled around the question of the so-called Eighth Thesis by Lenin. You know, the whole question of the nature of the revolution itself. Was it a bourgeois revolution or a socialist revolution? Yeah, the attitude to the provisional government and so on. But right throughout the year, at every decisive turning point in the revolution, you know, the July days, the Kornilov coup, the insurrection in October itself, you know, posed new questions that the Bolsheviks had to relate to. And a whole series of long-standing positions and debates either resurfaced or were challenged. You know, and there were debates over everything imaginable, you know, whether it was how to relate to the peasantry, the exact role of the factory committees compared to the trade unions and the Soviets, the actual slogan of all power to the Soviets, the nature of work amongst women. You know, you go through, an endless list in a way. And I'm not going to be able to address, you know, touch on any more than a few of those debates in this talk. What I'm going to centre around are three questions. The question of the attitude to the war, the national question, and the issue of how to relate to the Mensheviks and the question of unity with the Mensheviks and that. Okay, so starting out with the war question. Prior to Lenin's arrival back in Russia in April, the editorship of Pravda under Kamenev and Stalin had taken essentially a pro-war defensive position, very much in tune with the line being put forward by the leadership of the Petrograd Soviet, you know, which was the Mensheviks, social revolutionary, Tsar leadership of the Soviet. But the reality was it wasn't just Kamenev and Stalin. With the Tsar overthrown, a whole section of the Bolshevik Party, you know, softened their opposition to the war. Now, by the end of April and the conference of the Bolshevik Party that year, Lenin had largely turned that attitude around and he was aided in the fact by then it was becoming clear that the new provisional government was essentially had the same war aims as the Tsarist regime. You know, it was pursuing a very straightforward imperial policy and that had to shift things. But what I want to focus on more is the question which is actually not talked about very much at all, is the fact that Lenin decisively changed his own position on the war once he got back to Russia. And that, because the overwhelming, you know, if you read sort of most histories and the term associated with Lenin on the whole question of war is revolutionary defeatism and that. You know, the advocacy of the defeat of your own government in the war. And also, allied to that, was that in the early years of the war, Lenin had taken a very hard position against the peace slogan, which he saw as a concession to pacifist sentiment. Yet, in practice, the Bolsheviks came to power under the slogan, bread, peace and land, and all power to the Soviets. And actually, from when Lenin arrived back in Russia in April, he never again used the term revolutionary defeatism. And that definitively wasn't his position in the course of the year. Indeed, in the immediate lead-up to the October Revolution, one of the major talking points of the Bolshevik Party was that the capitalists and the generals in the Tsarist army were effectively backing a German invasion of Russia to crush the revolution. The Bolsheviks agitated against soldiers deserting the front, and when the major German offensive against Riga, it was actually Bolshevik-inspired troops, and amongst the Latvians is where the Bolsheviks had a real great strength, fought very hard in the unsuccessful defence of Riga. So how do we square all this? How do we unravel this? I think, and And essentially, I'll argue the position put forward in the quite comprehensive treatment of the issue by Hal Draper in his whole series of articles, which compiled together under the title The Myth of Lenin's Revolutionary Defeatism. Okay. So, well, the start point, I think, is in terms of understanding Lenin's involvement, the evolution of Lenin's position, was the analysis of Marxists of the whole nature of Russian society. If you go back to Marx and Engels, Russia was seen as this feudal backwater, but not just a backwater, a centre of reaction in Europe that had to be smashed by the development of capitalism. And in that context, socialists saw in the 19th century a military victory of a capitalist regime against Russia would have been a step forward. And Lenin had that position, and we see it continuing into the 20th century when the war between Russia and Japan broke out, that Lenin actually advocated strongly a Japanese victory in that war as being progressive and that. Now, but the reality was, by the outbreak of the World War I, capitalism had significantly changed with the development of imperialism and so on, the whole fundamental shift in the nature of world capitalism. Something, of course, that Lenin himself was to seriously address subsequently, in his writings on imperialism and so on. And that necessitated a major shift in the Marxist attitude to war. As well, the 1905 revolution had decisively demonstrated that the working class in Russia had sufficiently developed that it was now a force that was in a position to overthrow the feudal aristocracy, the autocracy in Russia, and usher in a new form of society. So it was no longer needed to see that, well, only way feudalism or the reaction could be defeated in Russia was by a capitalist invasion. However, it still was the case that at the outbreak of war, Lenin was very much influenced by the old formula And he still, at the outbreak of the war, still saw the defeat of the Tsarist armies by Germany as being progressive. Indeed, he argued that the Bolsheviks should wish for the defeat of Russia in the war and loudly proclaim a defeatist position. On the other hand, Lenin was also stridently denouncing the German social democracy for its pro-war stance. And what Lenin argued was that, well, it was correct for socialists in Russia to argue for a German victory and for the defeat of the Tsarist armies, but it was wrong for German socialists to do the same thing. Because of this, but this highly contradictory position, Lenin came under sharp criticism from a number of prominent Bolsheviks. And that was that sharp criticism was particularly because the actual argument that Lenin was using was precisely one of the arguments that the German Social Democrats were using to justify their pro-war stance. So I was saying Russia was so reactionary, and that it was so despotic regime that a German victory would advance democracy in the world and actually be a positive for the Russian working class. Okay. Now, in the face of that criticism, Lenin starts to shift his position, but he still wants to hang on to the defeat slogan. By early 1915, Lenin had dropped the idea that Russia was so reactionary that that it should be treated differently from the other imperialist powers involved in the war. And his slogan became now, to quote him, "to wish the defeat of the imperialist bourgeoisie in every country." He justified this shift by the argument that defeat in war facilitates revolution. Rather than the previous argument that the defeat of Russia was the lesser evil in the war. Now, it might be objectively true that a defeat in a revolution could facilitate revolt, you know, lead workers to rise up and so on. But that does not mean that socialists should actively call for defeat or actually engage in political activities which would, you know, enhance the possibilities of defeat. Because there's a whole series of other political developments that can, you know, enhance and open up the possibilities of revolution. You know, massive wage cuts, an economic depression, you know, a military coup, all these sorts of things could objectively, you know, stimulate revolt by workers and so on. But actually socialists don't argue for a Great Depression. We don't have to go on to facilitate these things happening. And in the face of continuing criticism inside the ranks of the Bolsheviks, including from Bukharin, most significantly, Lenin again shifted his position. His formula became then, by around the middle of 1916, the class struggle must not halt before the possibility of defeat. But this is an absolutely meaningless truism, and it guts defeatism of the content associated with the original formula. You know, only the term really remains now. So unlike a clear-cut slogan, for example, that was argued for by Trotsky, of turn the imperialist war into a civil war, the defeat slogan essentially became a sectarian shibboleth in the hands of both Lenin and Zinoviev, which they used quite contradictory arguments to continue to justify. Now, Lenin and Zinoviev, through the course of 1916, held on to the defeat slogan because they saw it very much as a sharp dividing line, you know, separate the sheep from the goats, and that particularly, you know, around the Zimmerwald conference and so on, you know, that this will be the sharp dividing line between more pacifist elements, you know, faltering elements in the middle, and the hard-line Bolsheviks and so on. And they denounced quite heatedly at the time other revolutionary opponents of the war, such as Trotsky, and that for not adopting the defeat slogan. Yet, as I said, back in Russia after April, the defeat slogan disappears from Lenin's political vocabulary. Why? Now, prior to the February Revolution, there'd been widespread defection of soldiers from the front. Immediately after February, that essentially ended. And there were still minor desertions, but the great mass of the soldiers immediately after February saw the situation had changed. They saw that fighting in their minds, they were fighting now to defend the revolution. And of course they still had illusions in the provisional government. Now, nonetheless, of course, the war remained an imperialist war. And the new capitalist government was just as committed to the imperialist war aim as the old Tsarist regimes. So it was vital in this context, on the one hand, to Lenin to deal with and argue against any pro-war wavering in the ranks of the Bolshevik Party. On the other hand, Lenin recognised that if the revolution was to advance, the Bolsheviks had to win over the mass of the rank and file of the army, at least to make substantial inroads amongst them. And Lenin saw that it was vital for revolutionaries in this context to make a distinction between the pro-war sentiment of the ruling class, the capitalists and the generals and so on, and what he called the honest defensism of the rank and file soldiers, who thought that they were fighting to defend the revolution and hold on to the democratic gains of the revolution. And Lenin saw that if the Bolsheviks were to relate to them, that calling their slogan being, you know, we should wish for or actively collaborate in the victory of the German armies was no way that they were going to win over the soldiers. What the Bolsheviks had to do is patiently explained to the soldiers that the war was still an imperialist war, that the provisional government wasn't there to defend their interests, wasn't there to defend against the revolution and so on, and that they wanted to gain more territory, make bigger profits and so on. Furthermore, Lenin recognised that the war was not going to be ended by just, you know, soldiers abandoning the front. It could be only ended by a continuing advance of the revolution itself, by a revolutionary workers' government being established, centred around the Soviets, which would then have the credibility to appeal to the working class and the other combatant countries, in Germany and so on, to end the war. Now, the concrete developments in the course of 1917 further undermine Lenin's, you know, original 1915 formulation, that the defeat in the war axiomatically facilitated revolution, let alone that in principle Marxists should work for the defeat. Because by August 1917, that it was the capitalists who were looking for defeat in the revolution. And particularly they were looking for setbacks initially because they thought if the Russian army suffered significant defeats, then this would be an argument that they could use to increase discipline in the army, restore execution of soldiers that weren't fighting and so on, and that. And secondly, and then closer to October the 7th, it was clear that there was a generally developing a sentiment in the higher ranks of the bourgeoisie and amongst sections of generals who saw a German victory as the lesser evil, you know, that a German victory could be used to crush revolutionary Petrograd. And that. Then the question then is posed is, well, if Lenin abandoned the slogan of revolutionary fetishism in 1917, why in subsequent history has it gone down that this was Lenin's position and that? Why had it become so established? And it's sort of axiomatically established, Lenin war means revolutionary defeatism and that. And I think we have to see that is clearly a legacy of Stalinism and the whole Stalinist counter-revolution. While Lenin was alive, the slogan of revolutionary defeatism was not used. It was not used in the early revolutionary years of the Communist International. When was this slogan revived? It was revived by Zinoviev after Lenin's death in his fights with Trotsky and so on. It was used, they very much saw, as part of the general attack on Trotsky, you know, hauling out Lenin's polemics against Trotsky in the early years of the war and that as a way of isolating and discrediting him and so on. And subsequently, under Stalinism, it becomes established as sort of a Stalinist article of faith, that this was Lenin's position and so on, that revolutionary defeatism was some sort of principle of socialism. Okay, to move on to the national question. Well, in an empire where over half the population consisted of oppressed non-Russian nationalities, that the how to approach the national question was a vital one. How were socialists to overcome the divisions in the working class and unite them around a revolutionary project? Now, the point of controversy was over the question of the right of national self-determination, i.e. the right of nations within the Russian Empire, more broadly, of course, to secede and set up their own nation-state. Now, as early as 1903, there have been major debates in a Russian social democracy over this issue. You know, in that year, the Polish Social Democrats, figures like Luxembourg and Felix Dzerzhinsky and so on, had walked out of the party congress that year because they were so hostile to the idea that the party should adopt a policy supporting the right of national self-determination and that. But it wasn't just the... they saw it, adopting a policy of supporting the right of national self-determination as a capitulation to the national bourgeoisie of the oppressed nations. But it wasn't the opposition to the slogan wasn't just confined to the politically social democrats and that. There were major disagreements within the ranks of the Bolshevik Party itself. Between 1912 and 1916, a group of Bolsheviks around Piatnikov and co. And Bukharin argue that while it was correct to support anti-imperialist struggles in the colonial world, and that they supported them there because they saw them as either pre-capitalist or countries in which capitalism was only developed to a minor extent. When it came to Europe and the advanced capitalist world, they saw this slogan as being reactionary. As they write, from an economic point of view, national independence represents an antiquated, obsolete, impossible object. The demand for independence is reactionary, for it desires to turn back the march of history. Now, I want to be clear. Piatnikov and the others did not deny that the nationalities, national groups in Russia, the non-Russians, were oppressed. He thought they were oppressed, but they argued. The answer to the bourgeois imperialist policy must consist in a socialist revolution of the proletariat. To fight for the liberation of nations within capitalist society is to divert proletarian forces from the actual solution to the problem, and their fusion with the forces of the corresponding national bourgeois groups. The task of social democracy at the present time is a propaganda of indifference with respect to the fatherland. And I think the last sentence sort of reflects sort of this sort of, in a sense, sort of a sort of an anarchistic, nihilistic approach to the national question. We just should sweep it away, and that an abstentionist washing of your hands in terms of relating to it. Now, Piatnikov and Bukharin were in a minority at the 1916 Bolshevik Conference, which debated out this issue and reaffirmed the Bolshevik support for the right to national self-determination. But the issue flared up sharply again after the February Revolution, in response to developments in Finland, Finnish Parliament, call for greater self-determination for Finland. Now, the provisional government in Petrograd, with the backing of the Mensheviks, forcefully opposed the right of the Finnish government to have greater self-determination, greater autonomy, and threatened to send in troops to disperse and crush the Finnish Parliament. On paper, the Mensheviks were abstractly committed to the right of self-determination, but they'd moved significantly to the right, and very much saw themselves and posed themselves as champions to the defence of the integrity of the Russian Empire. Now, in this context, the ultra-left opposition inside the Bolshevik Party to the right of national determination could only provide a left cover for the Mensheviks, and so on. Now, Lenin immediately came out in support of the right of Finland for greater autonomy. Indeed, he argued that the Finns had the right to break away and set up their own independent state. But at the Bolshevik Central Committee meeting on the 19th of April, Lenin's motion along these lines was defeated. And this foreshadowed a sharp debate at the Bolshevik conference, which was to be held about 10 days later. Indeed, Lenin was opposed in the lead-up and at the Congress itself by pretty much every representative in the Bolshevik Party of the non-Russian minorities. Dzinski from the Poles, Piatnikov from the Ukrainians, the Georgian Makaradis, and numerous others and that. And this allowed a space for the notorious manoeuvrer, one Joseph Stalin, and that, who had blotted his copybooks badly by his effective support for the provisional government to begin to rehabilitate himself. Because Lenin was determined to find a non-Russian to introduce his motion at the conference, arguing for the right of national self-determination. Stalin was given the role. But if you actually read Stalin's speech, it was clear he didn't understand the question much at all. It was a far from impressive speech. It really did nothing to advance Lenin's cause. And Lenin himself was forced to intervene very sharply in the course of the debate, and particularly in responding to a counter resolution moved by Piatnikov and that. And the actual Lenin eventually had his resolution carried, but it was there was substantial opposition to it. By far, the biggest opposition to Lenin, to any motion Lenin supported at the conference and that. Lenin's position was carried by 56-4, 16 against, 18 abstentions, and so on, and that. Now, Lenin, was aided by the fact that in the course of the debate, Piatnikov had tied himself up in knots. Because he argued, well, I'm against the right of national self-determination, but I'm also against the use of force by a government to prevent a national minority seceding. As Lenin said, well, if you've got a nation that's determined to secede, the only way it is going to be prevented from seceding is by force, and that substantially. And I think that's one of the reasons it explains the high level of abstentions and that. People who didn't like Lenin's position could see Piatnikov's position was essentially untenable. Okay. Now, it's worth going through in a bit of detail Lenin's actual motion. It goes, the right of all the nations forming part of Russia really to secede and form independent states must be recognised. Deny them this right is equivalent to supporting a policy of seizure or annexation. Only the recognition by the proletariat of the right of nations to secede can ensure complete solidarity amongst the workers of the various nations and help to bring the nations closer together on truly democratic lines. The right of nations freely to secede must not be confused with the advisability of secession by a given nation at a given moment. The party of the proletariat must decide the latter question independently in each particular case, having regard to the interests of social development as a whole and the interests of the class struggle of the proletariat for socialism. The party demands broad regional autonomy, the abolition of a compulsory official language. So Lenin was very clear that in order to foster unity between the non-Russian workers, the workers of the oppressed nations within Russia, and workers of Russian origin, that the revolutionaries had to take a very clear line against national self-determination and grant the right of minority nations to secede. And it was up to the Georgians or the Azerbaijanians or the Ukrainians, the Letts and so on, to decide whether they actually would secede. This was not the right of Russian workers or the Russian population more generally to decide on. But, as Lenin's very clear as well, the support for the right to secede did not necessarily mean you're going to advocate that particular nation seceding. Where Marx stood on that was a very concrete question, and that in terms of what was seen as being as advancing the class struggle and so on. And it remained the case, if even in the case where the national oppressed national minorities did argue for secession and so on, it was still the responsibility of revolutionaries in those countries to argue for international working class unity, to argue against the nationalism of their own bourgeoisie, and so on. And clearly, Lenin's stance on this question has still got important relevance for today. God is, it is far from being the case. You know, we see 100 years later that the argument of Piatnikov and co. that, you know, the whole national question in advanced capitalist countries is a historically antiquated question which has disappeared from the face of history, and that is no longer the case at all. Not just no longer the case, it hasn't been the case for the last 100 years, and it's still sharply posed in Europe today. And we have to just think of the example of what's going on in Catalonia now. Okay. The third question, the issue of the break with the Mensheviks. Now, there's been long been a significant element, current, in the Bolshevik Party that was sympathetic to unity, at least with a section of the Mensheviks. And at a rank and file level, that was particularly strong outside the major centres, which were, you know, very much removed on a day-to-day basis from a lot of the heated arguments and the disputes that were taking place in Petrograd or Moscow and that. In the immediate aftermath of the February Revolution, pro-unity sentiment surged and that. You know, the whole thing was seen, you know, we're all comrades together in the overthrow of the Tsar, and that surely we could unite. You know, we needed a united Socialist Party to defend the revolution. And it was not just, by any means, raw recruits that shared this sentiment. You know, Kamenev and Stalin were pushing this argument hard and that. And the reality was they pretty much had the same position as the left wing of the Mensheviks, the Menshevik internationalists and that, on the decisive questions at the time. You know, over the attitude of the provisional government, that they were defensists on the war, and did not think socialist revolution was on the agenda. And Stalin explicitly argued, quote, "We must do it, the ally unity. It is necessary to define our proposal for a basis of union. Union is possible on the basis of Zimmerwald-Kienthal." Now, Zimmerwald-Kienthal refers to the fudge position on the war adopted at the Zimmerwald conference. Now, in the minds of many of these old Bolsheviks, a lot of the differences between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks going back to the time of the 1905 revolution now seem to be resolved. Now, these are somewhat complicated questions, but see, at the time of the 1905 revolution, the Mensheviks argued that it was a bourgeois revolution taking place, which had to be led by the bourgeoisie, and that what would happen would be then, you know, a bourgeois government would be set up and socialists would not participate in that government. They would form an opposition to it. And that. Now, the Bolsheviks agreed at the time, in 1905, yes, it would be a bourgeois revolution, but there was no way that the bourgeoisie was going to lead this. The working class and the peasantry would be the forces that overthrew Tsarism. And in that context, the Bolsheviks argued that there would be then a new revolutionary government would be set up, which the Bolsheviks would participate in to push through the revolution as far as it could go, win as many reforms as possible, before eventually handing over power to a subsequent capitalist government. Okay. Now, however, in 1905, the Tsar survived. There was no new revolutionary government set up in that. So the question of whether to participate in it or not didn't concretely arise. In February, the scenario was different. The Tsar was overthrown, but no revolutionary government was set up. The Soviets could have set up, been the basis for a revolutionary government, but effectively they allowed the bourgeoisie to regroup and form a provisional government, which was no sense revolutionary. But unlike in 1905, when the Mensheviks said they wouldn't participate in a new bourgeois government, they were uncritical, effectively, of the provisional government and did argue for the participation within it and that. Now, some of the old Bolsheviks, adhering to the old formulas around 1905, saw this essentially mean that the Mensheviks had come over to the Bolshevik position from 1905. Because the Bolsheviks in 1905 said, well, we participate in a revolutionary government. You know, and if you thought the provisional government was a revolutionary government, well, it seemed then that, well, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks have got a similar position. Now, of course, Lenin went right back, is for none of this at all. You know, he was arguing, arguing no way should we support or participate in the provisional government, but also no way could we have unity with the pro-capitalist Mensheviks. The provisional government had to be overthrown, and a new government headed by the Soviet had to be created. Now, Lenin's argument against unity of the Mensheviks won out decisively, at least on the terms of the votes, at the April conference in the year. But that doesn't mean to say that softness on the Mensheviks disappeared, far from it. And this was particularly the case outside the capital, Petrograd. In pretty much all of the smaller centres, this is overwhelmingly case east of the Urals, actually the break between the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks came quite late in the course of the revolution, and that, you know, in a number of cases it didn't take place until actually after the October Revolution itself. And this reflected a number of factors. So, for example, in Siberia, and other isolated regions, you know, all the debates and what was going on in Petrograd, you know, weren't fully understood. The information didn't flow through. The Bolshevik Central Committee had limited contact with what was there going on, and so on. And as well, in these areas, there wasn't, you know, a mass factory proletariat as in Petrograd or Moscow, which was being decisively radicalised as well. These areas were well away from the war front, and that means that the whole issue of the nature of the war was less sharply posed in a lot of these areas. As well, in most of Siberia, the right wing of the Mensheviks was quite small, and they were the most, you know, openly pro-war elements, and consequently what you see in most of these centres is combined organisations being set up between Bolsheviks conciliators and the internationalist wing, the so-called internationalist wing of the Mensheviks, and with fudge positions on the war itself and its relationship to the provisional government, and what was often referred to as Siberian Zimmerwaldism. And in a fairly typical case, the first Legal Socialist Committee formed in Tomsk consisted of both Mensheviks and Bolsheviks, and they voted that the question of the attitude to the war would be left up to a future constituent assembly to resolve. They abstained from the war. And further compounding the problem in a lot of these centres was the massive growth of the new socialist organisations being spread up. Was bringing up, often in these areas, the socialist committees were formed by a few groups of exiles, often people who had been exiled in Siberia and so on. Now, they'd set up a committee, and then hundreds, or if not thousands and thousands of people, of new recruits would join them. So the revolutionary exiles were often swamped. And this created a serious tactical problem for the more left-wing Bolsheviks. For example, in Krasnoyarsk, there was a significant minority of more left-wing Bolsheviks was highly critical of the other Bolsheviks, and the conciliation wing of the Bolsheviks, and of the left Mensheviks, and that. It was a heated debate amongst them, tactically how to proceed, And they voted to join the new combined organisation that was being set up in order to struggle within it for a revolutionary standpoint. And they decided initially they'd stay in for a month. When they broke from it, the combined organisation at the end of May, they took out 106 out of 2,500 members. Now, in retrospect, of course, this can seem as very premature split in terms of the small minority they took out. But they were confronting quite difficult circumstances, how you exactly tactically orient, and that with little advice coming through from the Central Committee in Petrograd, and they weren't to know, you know, how developments in the war and so on over the coming months, you know, if they'd stayed in a bit longer, but possibly they could have taken out a lot more. In the end, in these areas, it was the actual success of the seizure of power in October that settled the question and that. So in the end, you know, these outlying areas followed Petrograd and Moscow and that. And because of the rank and file, the new rank and file of these socialist committees enthusiastically backed the October Revolution and that. And under pressure from that, you get a whole layer of the leadership of them joined the Bolshevik Party in October or immediately after and that. Okay. That wasn't the end of the issue. In Petrograd itself, the issue flared up very sharply at the time of the October Revolution and the immediate aftermath of it. Because, you know, a number of leading Bolsheviks, you know, people like Kamenev and Zinoviev, argued against the Bolsheviks forming their own government and that. Even though the Bolsheviks had the backing of a clear majority of the All Congress of Soviets, Zinoviev and Kamenev and a number of others argued for instead that they should have an all-socialist government and that. Now, Kamenev and co. were prepared to go as far as countenancing having a combined government which excluded Trotsky and Lenin, who was seen by the Menshevik's proponent of the combined government as too radical and too revolutionary. And indeed, shortly after the October Revolution, there was a section backed by people in the local council who attempted an uprising in Petrograd against the Soviet seizure of power. And Mensheviks actually argued for the leader of that uprising to be incorporated into the government. And Kamenev was prepared to go along with this and that. This, of course, this would effectively mean handing over power to the people who had opposed the revolution. And that, now, and we ought to be clear, it was not just Kamenev and Zinoviev, the right wing of the Bolshevik Central Committee that had this position. There was a whole series of people in the middle on the Central Committee who wavered and opposed Lenin's position of cutting off all negotiations with the Mensheviks and so on. And the majority still voted to continue with the negotiations, even if their positions weren't quite as soft as Kamenev and co. But let's be clear, it's quite a significant phenomenon, that this wavering was pretty much confined just to the Central Committee and a few people around them and that. Because unlike the rank and file of the Bolsheviks, you know, it was, you know, the you know, sections of the top leadership, you know, had most day-to-day dealing with the leadership of the other reformist parties, who were most influenced by bourgeois public opinion, intellectual circles, and so on. Whereas actually, amongst rank and file Bolsheviks in the Petrograd factories, and that there was profound hostility to the Mensheviks and the SRs for the fact that they wouldn't back a Soviet government and that. And that was reflected, that sentiment was reflected too at the local area committees of the Bolshevik parties and on the Bolshevik Petrograd Committee. So, for example, you see how this works out. Two of the main proponents of unity with the Mensheviks and a combined socialist government were the central trade union leaders in the Bolshevik Party, Ryazanov and Lozovsky, and that. but a rank and file, a conference of rank and file delegates in the unions was called to vote on this question and that. And Ryazanov and Lozovsky were decisively repudiated, whereas the rank and file union delegates voted for by 112 to 33 for an all Bolshevik government. And that. And these developments increasingly isolated the more moderates on the Central Committee of the Party and that. And this isolation was further compounded by the increasingly outrageous demands of the Mensheviks and the right-wing of the SRs. As the historian Alexander Rabinovich, who you have to say is fairly sympathetic to the moderate Bolsheviks, writes, unfortunately for the Mensheviks and the SRs, the Bolsheviks' initial revolutionary decrees and their apparent toughness in dealing with the internal and external counter-revolution had rejuvenated the revolutionary spirit of Petrograd's lower classes, a fact reflected in the expansion of support for Lenin's position at the local level. And in turn, this rank-and-file level, which is not just confined to the rank-and-file Bolsheviks, it's confined to the mass of the rank-and-file of the factory proletariat, impacted the left SRs. And I think it's the decisive reason the left SRs eventually break with the right SRs on this question, because they previously too advocated for an all-party socialist government and actually went into a coalition government with the Bolsheviks. Okay. So to finish up, well, a few general points really. The sheer vibrancy of the debates which took place in the Bolshevik Party in 1917, I think, is one of the most decisive refutations of the sort of common slander, the common right-wing argument. You know, the Bolsheviks are this dictatorial, top-down party, you know, run by Lenin, nobody can step out of line, there's no debate, and so on. When the reality is, of course, in the 1917, as, you know, the few examples I pointed, there was just debate going on all the time and that, you know. And often, Lenin was in a minority. You know, there's a whole series of other examples I haven't touched on here, but Lenin was in the minority, and sometimes he was wrong, you know, about the timing of the revolution. You know, a whole series of things, you know, and that he was a minority, and you know, far from always getting his way, and as well, the debates wasn't, you know, there wasn't all these, you know, hard factional lines all the time. The leading peoples could be on one side of one debate, and then, you know, be with allies with other people in another debate. So there's this constant shifting and ferment of argument. The other element I think he's got to say is that to see that, you know, in that context, democracy and debate and argument are not some sort of just some abstract moral principles. They were a vital part of the whole discourse of how the Bolsheviks could successfully orient to the revolution, all the shifts and changes and emphasis and so on to be successful. You know, it was, you know, it was the part of the whole feedback process, the interaction between the top leadership, the cadre of the party, the rank and file, and so on, that opened up the space for the Bolsheviks to be able to successfully orient and take the revolution forward to victory. And I'll leave it there.